Lone Wolf Radio calling. Lone Wolf Radio calling. This is Lone Wolf Radio calling, and it is the 11th month, second day, 2020, and we're about ready to have a big old fight. An election coming up tomorrow. How about that? Let's get on to the show.
Commentary. As you all know now, by now, a young man by the name of Benjamin Smith joined a growing list of hunters this week, attacking several non-Aryans with small arms fire. War's policy is not to pass judgment on any militant act committed by any Aryan upon those of other races or whites deemed a threat to the overall survival and health of the racially conscious Aryan people in North America. I'm not going to give a long, drawn-out history of atrocities committed against Aryan activists around North America by non-whites, Jews, and Uyghur whites. That is an insult to your intelligence. We all know many activists and non-activist whites who are victims of anti-Aryan crime. These crimes are almost never called hate crimes. Hate crimes were designed specifically by Jews to use against Aryan white men or even a non-white that dares to offend a Jew. If you check the records, all hate crime model legislation was formulated by Jews. Want to argue about it? Want to debate about it? Well, they were. And they were enacted by anti-Aryan white politicians who are so afraid of the Jews they'll do anything. All U.S. attorneys and local district attorneys target white males, especially working-class white males, with hate crimes 98% of the time. All such people are your extreme enemies, and whatever happens to them is their problem. Today, even distributing literature is in the process of being criminalized. Raids on homes take place on nearly a daily basis around the country. They've gotten the green light to go hunting for us. Many are jacked up by Iron Heel police and threatened in any manner that the cops feel may be successful, including causing you to lose your ability to feed your family. I construe that as attempted murder. University personnel, instead of inviting speakers with different ideas to explain their beliefs in the free market of ideas, use every tactic to drive our ideas out of their institutions. Racists cannot buy airtime on TV or radio or newspaper space. Billions are spent vilifying our ideas and we personally. All institutions devote large amounts of their time attempting our destruction while brainwashing the youth. Perhaps the worst case is their combined arrogance. Like many authoritarian states, they boast of being democratic, which is the most obscene nonsense yet devised. They assume absolutely, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that we are wrong and they are right. Based upon these facts, it is a waste of time to talk to them at all. We have passed the point of no return. We are beyond failsafe. It's too late to call back the Aryan justice that speeds towards its target. It is them or us, boys and girls. It is far too late to waste time in political parties, membership groups, letter writing, or, sad to say, even literature distribution, unless it's of the most revolutionary type. Not trying to coddle the public. I suggest that new lone wolves, converts, stay aloof from distributing literature. Those of us that are already in the files and on the list have nothing to lose. Well, probably do, but not as much as someone they don't know. Do not give your enemies any warning whatsoever. The anarchists correctly called it the politics of the deed. In other words, save 99% of your time to educate yourself to action. There's a war going on. I repeat, don't waste your time arguing with your enemies or trying to convince them that you are nonviolent. To assure anyone that you are nonviolent is suicidal. It's like putting a sign in your window that says, "This house contains no guns." I implore all racial leaders to cease saying that you will never employ violence or never advocate it. There is no way you will salvage your race or territory without violence. You may correctly debate how that violence may be applied, but to deny its use is cowardly or ignorant. I suggest reading the book Hunter, or Civil War II, or The Making of an Assassin. That's the story of James Earl Ray's stalking of Martin Luther King by George MacMillan. One man did it. No conspiracy. One man. Then read every covert ops book you can lay your hands on. Above all, waste no more time following the eat, meet, and retreat options of the conservative right-wing racialists. They must change their ways or be left in the past. End of commentary. Questions. How much time do we have? We have no time if you mean by democratic peaceful action, writing your representatives, or joining a political party. If you mean by any means possible, we do have time. Bottom line is that we will be fighting a long, dirty war in North America with no holds barred on either side. Most of the present Aryan cadre will be killed or imprisoned. The following generation, however, will be much more vicious, devoid of compassion, and able to kill whoever or whatever stands in their way. No matter how radical my words sound, we are all infected with something that following generations will not have to deal with. Their leaders will revert to ancient tactics welded to modern technology. My generation has failed completely. Sorry, boys and girls. Question. I am a baby boomer. Where should I retire to? Well, for an Aryan activist to talk about retirement makes me sick. If you mean retire from the transnational corporations or quit the Iron Heel, then that's great. You can now devote all your time to defeating and destroying the beast. Today you can fight the beast anywhere, since the Iron Heel is everywhere. They're in every facet of our life. You can walk out the front door and fight the Iron Heel. Choose a small town away from a military base or a big city. A place with as little federal money controlling the town and the police as possible. A place where a fast mode of travel is within reasonable distance. Stay away from a place that depends on water from long distances. Stay away from the Mexican border or coastal areas like Miami and New Orleans, and so on. Most of this depends on your age, health, and finances also. How is Robert Shelton, the one-time leader of the United Clans of America, doing? Robert Shelton lives quietly in the town he has spent most of his life in. He is ill, quite ill, but his wife is still quite well, according to our sources. I get calls giving advice all the time, and many people have good ideas. Some, unfortunately, are a bit arrogant in their criticism. An example is the people who ask why I don't jump into this or that modern method, such as a voice on the internet and all these things, which we will probably do. This takes a lot of time and money, however. War is not a wealthy group and never has been. We have spearheaded innovation in the past that many forget about. When my phone machine gets a little poorly, some call and tip me off. I appreciate that. What I don't appreciate is the one who complains that our machine sounds like shit, and when are you going to own NBC TV? I know a lot of people think I, like other leaders, sit in an office in a compound somewhere and contemplate my navel. In fact, I do work for a living. Color that a job, as do all the Metzgers have jobs. I may be servicing a VCR and getting my hands dirty, or a TV. I may be putting up a large antenna on a two-story house, or installing a satellite dish. Oh my God, a common worker. Unlike most doctors, I make house calls. I'm a single widowed father of a 15-year-old daughter. I have a total of 6 children and 9 grandchildren. I remind you of this so that you may understand I have a life, plus the struggle, plus the business that puts food on the table. So if you call in and my phone machine sounds like shit, politely advise me, or if I misspell a word here and there in my updates or in my emails, please cut this old fart a little slack. If that's not possible, then go play on the freeway or the railroad tracks, boys and girls. Joke time. An Aryan is walking down the street when he sees a Jew with a long, very long pole and a yardstick. The Jew is standing the pole on its end and trying to reach the top of it with his yardstick. Seeing the Jew's ignorance, the Aryan wrenches the pole from his hand, lays it on the sidewalk, measures it with a yardstick, and says, "There, 10 feet long." The Jew grabs the yardstick and shouts, "You idiot, Aryan, I don't care how long it is, I want to know how high it is." Next joke, a nigger firing squad, they all stand in a circle. Next joke, New Mexican Navy, they've got glass-bottom boats to see the old Mexican Navy. Next joke, nigger kamikaze that flew 48 successful missions. Next joke, did you hear about the terrible automobile accident last night? A mestizo family on vacation lost all of their children. The pickup truck that they were riding in ran off the road into a lake and sank to the bottom. The parents got out of the cab okay, but all the kids in the back drowned. The kids couldn't find the tailgate to open. In case you missed it, the new Miss World is Miss Israel. Oh, surprise, surprise. Last week I spoke of using the use of depleted uranium in weapons and its environmental and human danger. A caller says depleted uranium is harmless. I don't think so. The Iron Heel uses depleted uranium, a waste product of the uranium enrichment process used for making atomic bombs and nuclear fuel, because it is extremely dense, 1.7 times as dense as lead. Depleted uranium is used in alloy form in shells to make them penetrate targets better. As the shell hits its target, it burns and releases uranium oxide into the air. The poisonous and radioactive uranium is most dangerous when inhaled into the body, where it will be released, and that radiation will be released during the life of the person who inhaled the dust. Now, your editor interviewed an active duty Marine who routinely has access to this type of ordnance. Oh, my God, ADL, ADL, alert, alert, alert. Metzger knows a lot of guys who have access to weapons. Two bad boys. Anyhow, he says these type rounds are never used at any U.S. base for training purposes. They're too dangerous. Even the teams who are in charge of the cleanup are aware of the danger. Many such personnel are already exhibiting many symptoms that are linked to radiation poisoning. I stand by my story that the use of depleted uranium is a disaster to the lands and peoples of the Balkans, and it makes the Iron Heel even more war criminals. The Holocaust shakedown money from Swiss banks will not be taxed. Oh, surprise, surprise. And a spokesman for the internet game site called Origin has apologized for the use of the term Zog. The Jews are upset that the term is anti-Semitic, a creation of the Order and Robert Matthews. Zog was the name of a fiction character from the game Ultima. So it seems Robert Matthews and his band of merry men have immortalized the term Zog. July 13th is the birthday of the creator of the KKK, General Nathan Bedford Forrest. Recently, Governor Frank Keating of Oklahoma vetoed the hate crimes bill in Oklahoma. Keating is a retired FBI agent. Perhaps the governor understands that Jew hate crime laws will endanger federal agents much more than they already are. More than 500,000 American veterans are homeless. That's 500,000. Thus are the fruits of corporate wars. And what do they fight for? Tell your friends that American Airlines is unsafe at any price. They're the biggest homosexual and non-white promoters over regular heterosexual white workers airline in the country. Pass it on. And they got people on the flight line who can't even speak English. Run, Eric, run. Eric Rudolph is still out there, either dug in or moving fast. The feds have asked hunters in the woods to keep an eye out for him. What a put down. Even the dress-wearing faggot J. Edgar Hoover would not stoop that low. You know, the homos hated Martin Luther King since J. Edgar Hoover was a homo, right? That's the logic they always use on us. This week, the Eat, Meet, and Retreat Council for Conservative Citizens met in Washington, D.C. with several other jack-off whiner groups. The topic, immigration. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it? After several hours of flapping their lips, they concluded with, write your representatives, admitting they had no power to make their representatives do a damn thing. You have power. I have power. Mind the border. If not the Iron Heel, why not Joe had enough? A few mines across the Mexican border would change things real fast. Do you know Jew Senator Dick Stein of New York in 1937 was the head of the group that evolved into the House Un-American Activities Committee? Did you also know he was a Russian KGB paid agent who was very close to important White House figures? Dick Stein was defeated for Senate back then, and then he became a New York State Supreme Court judge until his death, all the time a KGB spy. Did you know that a group that allegedly comprises of less than 10% of the population, the Jews constitute 75% of all treasonous spies against the U.S.? Joe McCarthy was right, as KGB records now show. But do you see a move on to clean up the name of Joe McCarthy? Of course not, as long as the Jews hate him. Anyone the Jews hate will be hated by their Judeo-Christian slaves. Joe McCarthy was totally right. And there were so many Jews involved in communism, it's unbelievable. Want to know where all the big-time Jew movie stars are buried in case you decide to desecrate a grave? Whoa, wait a minute. Ooh, watch that, boy. These are all in the L.A. area. The map is available from Grave Concerns, 10061, Riverside Drive, P.O. Box 730, Toluca, that's T-O-L-U-C-A, Lake, California, 91603. For updates on that situation, www.graveconcerns.com. Small stores in the South used to be called Jew stores because the Jews moved into the small southern towns and started cheap stores. A new book entitled The Jew Store by Algonquin Press details that history. Perhaps Morris Dees is the offspring of one of these Jew store owners. The Southern Baptists have decided they don't have enough Negroes and Spicklets in their church, so they are targeting the inner city to recruit more sheep for the shearing. It's now a race by all the churches to see how many non-whites they can suck in. Where I live, it's a race between the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Mormons as they go door-to-door pleading with the wretched refuse to join their ignorance. Now the new Spicklet recruits are hard at it going door-to-door. When you see them coming to your door, the best way to get rid of them, and this works every time, open the door, standing there stark naked as a jaybird. They won't come back. The book Hate, George Lincoln Rockwell and the American Nazi Party by William Smaltz is available. Phone number 202-333-2500 or www.glrockwell.com. But before you do that, buy This Time the World from War. Daniel Cohen Bendit. You probably don't remember that name. You might remember this. Known as Danny the Red in the 60s in France, was recently in Israel to get orders, we suppose. He is now a parliamentarian for the Green Party in the European Union. The European Union has become the most dangerous threat to Aryan Europe, with Jews swarming all over it like maggots. The Nationalist Observer is published by Alex Curtis. It's available from P.O. Box 152603, San Diego, California, 92195. Alex promotes a hard line for racial activists, none of this conservative crap. You may reach him at Alex or AX Curtis at AOL.com or his phone message at 619-286-6709. I hear the film Enemy of the State is a good film, especially since our advisors have told us virtually every electronic device in the film is now in use, plus many more against you. You will see that sneaking up on a fly is not easy, but the best way is the direct way in many cases. To get 150 minutes of useful spy video, some hot stuff, send $20 donations to War and ask for the spy video. Many great ideas from behind the line struggle or for the behind the line struggle. A letter from WCOTC, Church of the Creator. Dear Tom, on behalf of Reverend Hale and all creators, thank you for your support of the WCOTC and our comrade Ben Smith. It is deeply valued at this time, and the words in your press release mirror our thoughts and feelings. Thank you, and I know how happy and honored it would have made Ben to read such remarks coming from such a great fighter as you. We send a special rahoa to you, Comrade Metzger. Yours in sisterhood, Lisa, WCOTC, Women's Frontier. That's it for this week. Remember, think white, act white, be white, and remember, this is war.
Merchandise resist November 1st, 2020, 6:16 p.m., 19 hours ago, to me George Wallace. Tom Metzger says, many white racists found out the hard way that most Southern politicians who pretended to believe in segregation and separation during the 1950s and 1960s were phonies. Your editor found it terribly strange that during the last gubernatorial campaign in Alabama, a great number of so-called racists turned out for ex-Governor George Wallace. Even much of the KKK turned out for Wallace. By this time, I thought most movement people were wise to the ex-circuit court judge. Unfortunately not, so the following should put another, who has duped our people, behind us. The interview took place July 31st, 1980 on PBS Radio. The interviewer was Bill Moyers. The subject, Frank Johnson, federal district judge, considered for Supreme Court seat and later head of the FBI for a short time. Then Mr. Johnson returned to Alabama and was elevated to 5th District Court of Appeals. Judge Johnson was the enemy straight out, but read the following notes and decide who was the greater enemy, the good judge or Governor George C. Wallace. Moyers, you knew George Wallace at the University of Alabama, didn't you, Johnson? We went through last code the same time, yes. Moyers, what was he like them? Johnson, George Wallace was a strong follower of Franklin Roosevelt. Moyers, New Dealer? Johnson, and the New Deal concepts. He and I had many debates about socialism, governmental control of public utilities, the TV. I was absolutely against any governmental control of public utilities. It violated my concept of what the federal government should be doing. But George was probably the most liberal student in the law school at the University of Alabama, and he was out for a good number of years after he got out of the legislature. He was Jim Folsom, Governor Folsom's campaign manager for South Alabama, and Folsom was one of the most liberal governors at the South had. Even up till now. Moyers, how do you swing what happened? What finally made George Wallace what he was? Johnson, George saw the handwriting. He saw that race was going to be something he could use as political advantage, and he was shrewd and smart and capitalized on it. George Wallace was a great politician. You could never underestimate George Wallace. He would land on his feet regardless of how you threw him up, or what position he was in when you threw him. He's a professional politician, the best I've ever seen. Moyers, do you think he believed all that heat he was spouting? Johnson, I don't think so. No, I never do believe that he believed it. He doesn't believe it now. He acknowledges that he doesn't believe it now. Moyers, a lot of people believe that the first real clash between the two of you back in 1950 was just what he needed to win the governorship after he lost it the first time in 1958. And in fact, that he came to power partly because of that incident. I'd like to review that story. Johnson, all right. Moyers, it's 1959. Johnson, right. Moyers, George Wallace has been defeated in 1958 as a candidate for governor. He's still a circuit court judge and he's impounded, withheld, the voting records of the Civil Rights Commission once in order to study discrimination in the South. And you've threatened him with contempt of court if he doesn't turn them over to the Civil Rights Commission. Is that a synopsis of it? Johnson, that's not quite the posture. The Civil Rights Commission was created by the Congress, given authority to subpoena and examine voting right records not only in Alabama, but throughout the country. They came to Alabama first. They subpoenaed the records from Barber County and Bullitt County, two of the counties in then Judge Wallace's circuit. The act provided that if the subpoenas are not honored, the Civil Rights Commission is to apply to the district judge weren't there then functioning to enforce the subpoena. So, George Wallace impounded the records from the registrar and each of those counties. He told the Civil Rights Commission that I will not give them to you. If you send any FBI agents down here, I'll put them in jail. If any Civil Rights Commission employees come down here, I'll put them in jail. And he made all these fiery speeches on television. And I issued a show cause order directing that he produce the records of both counties for inspection, examination by the representatives of the Civil Rights Commission. He held some news conferences to the effect that he would not do it. I issued a show cause order as to why he shouldn't be found guilty of contempt of court, and gave him maybe 10 or 15 days, I don't recall how long I gave him, to show cause, in writing. In the meantime, from the time I issued the contempt order until the day he was supposed to show cause, he slipped around in the courthouse and Barber County and made most of the records available to the representatives of the Civil Rights Commission. He did it at night time, and I made those findings, and those findings are part of the court record. Moyers, he did it clandestine? Johnson, oh yes, absolutely. Moyers, he was complying, but he wasn't letting people know he was doing it. Johnson, absolutely. Moyers, and he was doing this because he didn't want to go to jail. Johnson, well, he wanted to go to jail for a little while. Moyers, for a little while. But he was afraid that you would put him up for a long time. Johnson, I told him if he didn't produce records, like I ordered him to, I'd pop him in jail for as long as I could. Moyers. All right now, let me examine that, because the story is it while this was going on he said sought a meeting with you, that he wanted to come to your house to work out something. And then he came to the house. Johnson, that's true. Moyers, and he knocked on the door. Now. Johnson, that's true. Moyers, the story is it with the door open there, he was holding his coat over his head. Johnson, that's true. Moyers, it was true. Johnson, that's true. Moyers, he didn't want the neighbors to know that he was calling. Johnson, he didn't want anyone to know. That's the way George operated. Moyers, what did he say? Johnson, what did he say? He says, Judge, my ass is in a crack. I need some help. That's the quote him verbatim. Moyers, verbatim. Johnson, my wife is in the bedroom, she heard him say it. I said, George, come on in. I made some coffee. He had had a mutual friend call me and tell me he was driving over 100 miles to see me, and I had some coffee for him. And we had a cup of coffee, and that's when he asked me if I'd send him to jail just a little while, it would help him politically. Moyers, and Johnson, I told him no. If you didn't comply with my order, I'd him to jail for as long as I could. Moyers, George thought you could send him up for 3 years, but under law, how much time could you have given them? Johnson, well, depending on whether I proceeded with contempt under the Civil Rights Act, and I think it had a maximum of 30 or 40 or 50 days. Or whether I proceeded under the general contempt statute and I could have sent him up for 6 months. Moyers. That's how he wanted the best of both worlds. He wanted to say that he defied your order, but at the same time he wanted to give them to the Civil Rights Commission. Johnson, sure, and he did. And when I made the findings that he had complied even though surreptitiously and deviously, I discharged him from being in contempt because he hadn't complied, That's what gave rise to his cry that he made famous, that anybody that says I didn't defy the federal court, anybody that says I didn't back M down, is an integrated scalawag and carpet-begging liar. Moyers, namely, Frank Johnson. Johnson, well, sure. But everyone that studied the record and everyone that knew the situation, knew that George Wallace lived the records to them. Moyers, and yet was able to say he defied the federal government. Johnson, he sold it to a large segment of the people in Alabama that he absolutely duped and hoodwinked. Moyers, he needed you, didn't he? He needed you as a scapegoat, Johnson, oh, of course. He needed anyone as a scapegoat. Moyers, just like any demagogue. Johnson, sure. I was just in a place that he could use. Moyers, and yet you must have despised everything George Wallace was up to. Daying the law, arousing passions. Johnson, of course, absolutely. I despise the fact that he was using the people in the state of Alabama for his own political gains. That he was lying to them, that he was misleading them, and that he was promising and holding out hope that he knew he couldn't give them. Did that in the Macon County case. Lead people to believe that they never would have to desegregate their schools. George couldn't believe that. Moyers, the irony strikes me that George Wallace had the voters, he had the notoriety, he had the ambition, and he had the guile, but in the end, it was an unelected federal judge who altered forever the face of the South. Reply forward.
Technically, George Wallace was not a racial separatist at all. He was just a slimy local politician who used our people in a race to get what he wanted. He also threatened to put George Lincoln Rockwell into the jail and arrest him when George Lincoln Rockwell showed up in Montgomery to have a rally. So, anybody tells you about George Wallace, tell him to talk to Tom Metzger. Doesn't he remind you of somebody who's the president right now? Same kind of stuff. People are going to have to learn the hard way again. But they're all that way. It don't make any difference whether it's Biden or Wallace or Trump or whoever. They're all rats. Sorry, folks. Got to tell it to you.
Will the 2020 elections change history? If they do, it won't be because one or the other candidate won, but because they accelerated the polarization that brought down the American empire. Political partisans, including most of the mainstream media, MSM, are screaming from the rooftops that the fate of the known universe depends on the outcome of Trump v. Biden. The dominant anti-Trump MSM faction casts Trump as a new Hitler who has exterminated more than 200,000 Americans in a coronavirus holocaust. Why not say 6 million and imprison anyone who disagrees? Critics say Trump is a malignant narcissist and egomaniac, which is true. They call him a mental midget, or as several of his senior military advisors have said, a moron, which is also true. They say Trump has wrecked the system of so-called alliances with occupied vassal states on which the U.S. empire depends. That, unfortunately, is not entirely true, but give Trump another term and he might get there. If Donald Trump did actually finish off the Anglo-Zionist empire, The good news is that he would go down in history as a hero of world historical stature. The bad news, for Trump's ego anyway, is that he would be credited with destroying the evil empire through sheer incompetence. If such happens, inshallah, perhaps he will be immortalized by statues of him stumbling on a stairway, whipping at a golf ball, or ingesting vast quantities of junk food and Diet Coke while staring hypnotized at a big screen tuned to Fox News. Future archaeologists will decipher the lapidary legend, "My name is Donald J. Trump, King of Kings, look on my works, ye mighty," and despair. Such would be a fitting epitaph for our age, and for the obese imperial colossus that sat best righted. The liberal MSM pundits who envision Trump destroying the USA and its empire imagine that a Biden presidency would, by contrast, save America, and perhaps the world. Biden, they say, would patch up U.S. alliances and resurrect the moribund institutions by which the U.S. has dominated the planet since World War II. According to the Never Trumpers, Biden will slay the coronavirus, stop global warming, rehabilitate America's reputation and soft power, put Russia and China in their places, save Israel from its own hubris, and refrain from tweeting utterly insane things every 20 or 30 seconds. Pro-Trump pundits offer a mirror image vision of why the world will end if our candidate loses. They imagine that if Biden wins, George Soros and his legion of Antifa terrorists will take over America, burning and looting whatever is left in the stores after the next COVID lockdown. Law-abiding citizens' guns will be confiscated. America's borders will be flooded by non-white immigrants. Crime will rage out of control. Police will call in sick. The internet will be purged of conservative voices. And brain-dead Biden will quickly be replaced by a vicious prosecutor named Commissar Kamala, who will become America's first ethnically ambiguous female dictator. In contrast to the cartoonish visions of political partisans, history suggests that it matters less and less who gets elected president. Each succeeding election becomes the new least consequential election in U.S. history, and the 2020 election appears to be no exception. Candidates are selected by an oligarchy of politically active billionaires who set strict limits on policy agendas. No president ever has the political capital to pursue more than one or two major policy proposals, which generally get watered down anyway even if eventually approved. No U.S. president has imagined that he is really president since JFK was executed for that crime in 1963. And since the Trilateral Commission chose an obscure Georgia governor named Jimmy Carter to launch the neoliberal revolution in 1976 and then replaced him with the more radical Ronald Reagan in 1980, the oligarchs haven't even bothered to go through the motions of pretending America is a democracy. The 2003 introduction of black box voting machines, better termed vote fabricating machines, formalized the permanent state of emergency inaugurated by the September 11, 2001 National Security Special Event Day. Donald Trump campaigned on a long list of extravagant promises, end all foreign wars and reveal who really did 9/11, bring the troops home, pull out of the Iran nuclear deal, Jake Po, ban all Muslims from entering the U.S., wall off the entire southern border at Mexico's expense, end NAFTA, CAFTA, TPP, and all trade treaties, bring manufacturing back to America, end NATO, and all alliances, unless the vassals vastly increase their tribute payments, which they won't, rebuild America's infrastructure, demand, and get vastly better trade terms from China, resurrect 1950s-style family values, and restore Americans' pride in their history. These are, in essence, the specifics behind Trump's promise to make America great again. So how much of that agenda did Trump accomplish? Only the tiny fraction supported by oligarchs. A cabal of Zionist extremist plutocrats wanted to pull out of the JCPO and exert maximum pressure on Iran, so Trump was allowed, or directed, to pursue that insane and inhuman initiative. Other than that, Trump fulfilled none of his promises, because the oligarchs wouldn't let him. Instead, following oligarchs' orders, Trump lavished money on tax cuts for billionaires and record increases in the military budget. Aside from Iran policy, a Hillary Clinton presidency wouldn't have been all that different. Clinton might have thrown slightly less money at the billionaires and the military-industrial complex, but not enough less for ordinary people to notice. Trump is hardly unusual. Recent presidents have increasingly accomplished less and less of whatever their ostensible policy agenda was supposed to be. Obama was elected to close Guantanamo, end torture, end the 9/11 wars, prosecute the war criminals, restore the Constitution and the rule of law both domestically and internationally, reduce economic inequality and racial disparities, and stop wasting money on foreign wars in favor of domestic spending while increasing average American standard of living. Needless to say, he did not accomplish any of those things, as predicted by my 2008 book Questioning the War on Terror. Previous presidents were almost equally ineffectual. George W. Bush, 2000-2008, was elected on promises to end America's role as world policeman and, incidentally, stop kidnapping pro-Palestinian Muslims on fake terror charges. The Muslim vote put Bush in office. Instead, Bush was himself kidnapped on September 11, 2001 when his orders to fly from Florida to Washington, D.C. were disobeyed, and he was coerced into spending the rest of his presidency reading from the neocon Zionist 9/11 coup perpetrator's script. Bill Clinton, 1992-2000, like Trump and Obama, came into office pushing significant policy initiatives. He charged his wife Hillary with shepherding a single-payer national health care plan through Congress, and he intended to force Israel to completely withdraw from 1967 occupied territories in return for peace. But the insurance lobby demolished the former plan, while the Zionist lobby and its agent Monica Lewinsky devoured the latter. So all Clinton really accomplished was neoliberalizing the globe under billionaire orders, and learning who really runs the world. So whether Trump wins a second term or Biden replaces him, the U.S. empire will mostly likely continue to decline in more or less the same fashion. Hostility, sanctions, and the possibility of war will dominate relations with Russia and China. Biden might return to the JCPO, easing overt tensions with Iran, but the covert Zionist-directed war on the Islamic Republic will continue no matter who is in office. Meanwhile, ordinary Americans will continue to be plundered by the oligarchs, the military-industrial complex and its Zionist friends, and other powerful special interests. A private banker's cabal will keep creating the entire currency supply out of nothing by lending it into existence at compound interest. Debt will keep increasing and the petrodollar will keep slipping toward the precipice. Infrastructure will continue to crumble. there will be no national public health care because the oligarchs and insurance companies won't allow it. Manners and morals will continue to decline. Oligarch-directed hoaxes and lies, along with bread and circuses, will distract the public. In short, nothing will really change. This year more than ever, American voters have been whipped into a frenzy of sound of fury signifying nothing. When the hoodwinked sheeple yanked the levers of their rigged voting machines, like suckers yanking levers of Sheldon Adelson's rigged slot machines in Las Vegas, they may think they are participating in the making of history when all they are really doing is demonstrating their own ignorance and gullibility. The real issue, polarization-induced civil strife, but by working themselves up into a political lather, and yanking those voting machine levers so hard, the voters might actually be helping make history, but not in the way they intended. They may be setting themselves and their country up for a failure of epic proportions. Whether that failure would be the deliberate result of a plan by the globalist elite to divide and conquer America in service to the Great Reset is beyond the scope of this article. The United States of America has experienced countless episodes of mass domestic violence, but only two all-out civil wars, in the 1770s and 1860s. 1. Today, many observers expect a post-election flare-up of unrest that could conceivably erupt into another civil war or even multiple civil wars. The levels of polarization and fanaticism seen today have not been witnessed since 1860, when an unusually galvanizing election set the stage for what has been variously termed the American Civil War, the war between the states, or, among Confederate sympathizers, the War of Northern Aggression. The parallels between the 1860 and 2020 elections are suggestive. In both cases, party realignment had destabilized the political system. In 1860, the Republican and Constitution parties were new, while the dominant Democratic Party had split into two factions over the issue of slavery in the Western territories. Likewise, in 2020, voters will choose from political parties that have shifted positions. Trump's newly populist Republican Party has attracted much of what used to be the Democrats' working class base, while the Democrats have shamelessly embraced their new identity as the party of the moderate billionaire oligarchs, to exactly what the Republican Party used to be. Like the 1860 election, the 2020 election will poll a starkly divided nation worked up into a frenzy over race-related issues, facing a stark choice about the future direction of the nation. In 1860, the key issue was whether new states in the Western territories should allow slavery. If slavery was banned in all new states, as Republican candidate Abraham Lincoln urged, the Southern slave states would become an increasingly disempowered and untenable minority faction in the Union, eventually facing economic ruin as the tariff-loving industrial North grabbed an ever greater share of the South's wealth. When Lincoln won, Southern leaders foresaw looming disaster, and felt compelled to secede from the Union in hopes of saving their economy and preserving their sovereignty. In 2020, populist conservatives likewise feel existentially threatened and might want to fight and slash or secede if they lose. Just as the looming demolition of the slave system foretold an apocalyptic end to the antebellum South, today onrushing demographic change threatens white-majority America. Alongside that demographic change, which promises to reduce whites to minority status by 2044, the destruction of working-class jobs through global outsourcing and automation threatens to impoverish much of what was once the mostly white, American middle class. Meanwhile, religious and family values are eroding, in part due to an all-out ideological assault by a media and academy dominated by secular progressive, disproportionately Jewish elites. Those increasingly radical elites embrace all varieties of victimization-based identity politics, starting with a pro-Zionist Jewish identity politics aimed at maintaining Jewish privilege while casting whites as monolithic villains whose efforts to defend their own interests are relentlessly demonized. Today, white identity advocates like Kevin McDonald and Jared Taylor, and their fellow travelers in the pro-Trump camp, feel about the same way Southerners did in 1860. If the election swings the wrong way, they will witness the annihilation of their country and way of life. Better to go down fighting, many say, than accept such an inglorious fate. Like the secessionists of 1860, today's rebels may react to a Biden win by picking up their guns in support of Trump's efforts to contest the results. Out of the resulting chaos might emerge a series of armed confrontations between various rural, pro-Trump, and urban, pro-Biden, areas, as well as a larger clash between red states and blue states that could conceivably escalate into a civil war redux. How the U.S. military, split between pro- and anti-Trump factions, and local and state police, mostly pro-Trump, would react remains to be seen. But Trump supporters are not the only ones who might react violently to an election loss. If Trump wins, or claims victory, the Black Lives Matter, BLM, and Antifa protests from last summer will likely flare up into a series of regional brush fires, if not a nationwide inferno. The dominant liberal faction of the mainstream media, MSM, will echo Biden's June 11th statement that the military should escort Trump from the White House with dispatch. Militias and Trump sympathizers in the military might mount an armed resistance against Trump's forceful ejection from the White House. The violence could easily spiral out of control. Skeptics may say, sure, there is plenty of chatter about post-election violence. But is there any actual evidence supporting the notion that this election is different from any other, and that people are more likely to violently contest the outcome? The answer is, yes, there is. A series of polls by YouGov shows that the number of Americans who believe violence is justified for their political party to achieve its goals has risen dramatically in just 3 years. In 2017, 8% of Americans supported political violence on behalf of their party. In 2018 it was 12%, in 2019 over 15%, and by June 2020 it had doubled to 30%. The latest poll, taken in September 2020, found that 33% of Democrats and 36% of Republicans support partisan political violence. Another factor driving potential post-election chaos is pent-up frustration over the COVID-19 lockdowns and the economic and social damage they have inflicted. Democrats have blamed Trump for all the COVID damage, with some success. Many Republicans, however, believe COVID was deliberately unleashed and slash or exaggerated in order to overthrow Trump. It is true that without COVID, Trump probably would have ridden the strong economy to an easy re-election, and it is also true that COVID is probably a deliberately released biological weapon, though Trump was almost certainly not the main target. As Americans have had their lives upended and degraded by the pandemic and lockdowns, they have been divided into two camps, each scapegoating the other for the terrible situation. History has shown how such mass scapegoating can devolve into mass bloodshed. 3. The underlying factors driving America's current trajectory towards civil war, including demographic change, the decline of religion, the rise of identity politics and the culture of narcissism, and economic inequality and the impoverishment of the working and middle classes are growing stronger every year. Polarization around the grotesquely divisive figure of Donald Trump may serve as the catalyst that sets off a chain reaction of violence. As conservative pastor Chuck Baldwin writes, Trump's vulgarities, blasphemies, duplicities, thefts, immoralities, racism, narcissism, covetousness, self-deification, misogyny, unconstitutional conduct and mass murders disqualify him from being elected dog catcher, much less president of the United States. But Trump's Republican supporters, like Democrats who supported serial rapist Bill Clinton and his rape-enabling wife Hillary, or war criminal Obama, or corrupt apparatchik and likely sex criminal Biden, follow President Roosevelt's reasoning about the vicious dictator Somoza. He may be a son of ABTCH, but he's our son of ABTCH. An election driven by such unprecedented levels of mutual hatred, with both sides increasingly ready to pull triggers rather than voting machine levers, could turn out to be a national booby trap. Whether it goes off in 10 days, 10 weeks, or 10 years, or miraculously fails to go off at all will, unlike the minor issue of who wins, determine the course of history. An earlier version of this article was first published in Crescent International Notes 1. The American Revolution was in fact a civil war between colonists in British North America, and involved massive bloodletting between revolutionary and anti-revolutionary factions. 2. The moderate Democrat oligarchs are funding radical causes like BLM and Antifa as a divide-and-conquer strategy against the working and middle classes. They are fomenting strife around identity politics, especially race, in order to lure leftists away from Bernie Sanders-style proposals to redistribute wealth. Antifa and BLM extremism also serve to discredit leftism, and by extension Bernie Sanders' agenda, in the eyes of the majority of working and middle-class Americans. 3. On the many Holocausts and genocides of recent history, see Gideon Pauliaz's Us Imposed Post 9/11 Muslim Holocaust.